Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. For most of us, he's remembered as a martyred president. But before he became president, Abraham Lincoln was a shrewd, sophisticated lawyer. Our guest this week, Alan Spiegel, addresses this less well-known aspect of Lincoln's life. And after that, for our weekly commentary, Jonathan Hansen puts in historical perspective the revived interest in patriotism on the American left since 9/11. But first, Dan Roberts continues his A Moment in Time series on Civil War woman spies.
By June 1862, Civil War Memphis, Tennessee was occupied by the Union. Young Belle Edmondson began her life as a smuggler and Confederate spy.
A Moment in Time with Dan Roberts.
Belle Edmondson was born in Pontotoc, Mississippi in 1840, the youngest of eight children. At the onset of the Civil War in 1861, the family was living on a farm just southeast of Memphis near the Mississippi border. Although there were some strongholds of Union sentiment, particularly in eastern Tennessee, the state had joined the Confederacy. The Edmondsons were staunch supporters of the Southern cause. Two of Belle's brothers fought at Shiloh, and Belle helped nurse the wounded from the battle. In 1862, Federal forces occupied Memphis, and the city became a vast supply depot. Belle Edmondson began slipping information and smuggled supplies to the Confederates. She kept a diary detailing her work as a spy. She would conceal cloth boots and hats in the inside of her wide dress hoops and hid letters, brass buttons, and money in her rather ample bosom. Belle successfully smuggled medicine and amputation tools through the Union lines, but in July 1864, she was forced to flee south to Mississippi. The Federals were on to her, had issued a warrant for her arrest, and planned to ship her to prison in Alton, Illinois. Few facts are known about her post-war life. Belle returned to the Memphis area and there befriended Jefferson Davis and his family when they were living there in the 1870s. After announcing her engagement to a mysterious Colonel H., she died in 1873 at the age of 33, probably due to one of the three epidemics that infested Memphis that year. According to family tradition, Colonel H. was a Yankee officer. Next time, a Union spy in Richmond. At the University of Richmond, this is Dan Roberts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we report on the launch of a new website that relates to the subject of our interview this week, Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's life was not all about being president. He also led a private life, much like all of us. That life is not only well documented, but it's now available to the public at a new website titled The Lincoln Log, a daily chronology of the life of Abraham Lincoln. The site lists almost everything we know about Lincoln's activities on a day-by-day basis. Just go to papersofabrahamlincoln.org and search for The Lincoln Log. This is Talking History.
Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. Avalon, my hometown, always on my mind. But if I was in Avalon, I was there all the time. But if mama's in Avalon, mama's there all the time. When I left Avalon, throwing kisses and waving at me. When I left Avalon, throwing kisses.
Before he became president, Abraham Lincoln was a successful lawyer. He represented individual and corporate clients in over 5,000 cases, ranging from murder trials to bankruptcy hearings. As our guest this week, Alan Spiegel, explains, his approach to the law was a mix of talent, humor, and honesty. Spiegel teaches at the Downstate Medical Center of the State University of New York. His remarks were recorded at station WNYE in New York City and provided to Talking History by the teacher as historian.
He was not a folksy, down-home kind of guy. Instead, he was a shrewd, sophisticated, tough, and aggressive litigator with a staggering caseload. He cared about making money and signed his legal papers as A. Lincoln, Esquire. During almost 25 years practicing law, Abraham Lincoln handled more than 5,000 cases. More than 400 of those were before the Supreme Court of Illinois. He represented individuals and corporations, plaintiffs and defendants, and prosecuted murderers and defended them. He argued for slave owners even while he disagreed with federal legal decisions supporting slave owners. He appeared before justices of the peace, county circuit court judges, state Supreme Court justices, and even the Supreme Court of the United States. Lincoln seldom turned any clients away. His cases included a long list of routine law cases: assault and battery, bad debt, bankruptcy, bastardy, bestiality, breach of marriage, divorce, impeachment of an Illinois justice, insanity, land titles, libel, medical malpractice, murder, partnership dissolution, patent infringement, personal injuries, property damages, rape, railroad bonds, sexual slander, slave ownership, and wrongful dismissal. Sometimes Lincoln argued on both sides of the same question, first for water transportation interests, later for railroad transportation interests. In 1853, a boat hit a pier under the Peoria Bridge in Illinois and sank. Boat owners filed a claim with Columbus Insurance Company. Columbus compensated them for the loss of the boat. In turn, the insurance company retained Lincoln to sue the bridge company to recover damages. During the trial in court, Lincoln, quote, challenged the power of the state to authorize a total obstruction of a navigable stream running within its territorial waters, unquote. There was a hung jury, and the case was dismissed. In 1855, Rock Island Bridge Company built the first bridge across the Mississippi River. F. V. Afton, the most up-to-date sidewheeler, crashed into several piers of the bridge. The ship caught fire and sank within 5 minutes. The captain sued the bridge company for $50,000 in damages. Lincoln defended the Rock Island Railroad transportation interests. He argued that, quote, people along the river had the right to cross in common intercourse. It was the manifest destiny of the people to move westward and surround themselves with everything connected with modern civilization, unquote. Lincoln and the engineer for the bridge company made a personal study of the rebuilt drawbridge. Lincoln researched the navigation of the river. He questioned other river captains about the high and low tides, tricky currents, water velocity, drifts, sandbars, and snags. On the 13th and 14th day of the trial, Lincoln delivered a meticulous, information-packed 8-hour summation. The verdict resulted in a hung jury, 9 for the railroad, 3 for water transportation. The case was dismissed, and there was no retrial. In 1855, Lincoln was retained in a patent infringement case. Cyrus Hall McCormick, the inventor of the original Reaper, sued John H. Manny and Company for $400,000 in damages for manufacturing Reapers using McCormick's patented improvements. Edwin McMaster Stanton was the lead counsel representing Manny. Lincoln was hired for the closing argument for Manny. He got a $400 retainer. As the trial began, Lincoln appeared in court, dressed like a typical Western farmer. He wore a linen duster for a coat. There were wide perspiration stains on the back of the coat. In addition, Lincoln wore heavy boots. Stanton greeted Lincoln in a boorish and discourteous manner. In disgust, Stanton spoke to another defense lawyer, quote, why did you bring that damn long-armed ape here? He does not know anything and can do no good. If that giraffe appears in the case, I will throw up my brief and leave, unquote. In the face of Stanton's antagonistic outburst, Lincoln withdrew from the case. He did keep the fee that he got for a retainer. Despite the tactless remarks of Stanton, Lincoln did not carry a grudge. At the opportune time, Lincoln appointed Stanton to be his Secretary of War because he was the best man for the job and for the country. A shrewd Lincoln got a murder charge dismissed. During a drunken brawl in 1858, John Banshouse fired a shotgun through a window. It killed a passerby. An inexperienced state's attorney tried the case. Lincoln took advantage of that inexperience. Without objection, he secured a change of venue and a continuance to locate witnesses. Unwittingly, the inexperienced prosecutor violated the statutory limit that a murder suspect must be tried within two consecutive terms of the court. On Lincoln's motion, the court dismissed the case on a technical violation of the speedy trial rule. Again, Lincoln demonstrated his shrewdness. During a drunken argument, the 77-year-old husband of 70-year-old Melissa Goings began choking her. Defending herself, she hit him on the side of his head with a piece of stove wood. He died 4 days later. Lincoln defended Melissa Goings on murder charge. During the trial, Goings suddenly disappeared. The court bailiff accused Lincoln of advising his client to leave the state. Lincoln responded, quote, "Oh, no, Bob, I didn't run her off. She wanted to know where to get a good drink of water, and I told her there was mighty good water in Tennessee," unquote. There was no further pursuit of Goings, and the case was stricken from the docket. A sophisticated Lincoln tackled medical experts. In 1855, a massive fire in Bloomington, Illinois, destroyed most of the town. A chimney fell on Samuel G. Fleming. Fleming broke both of his thighs, one a compound fracture. Dr. Thomas P. Rogers and Eli K. Carruthers treated him. After 5 months, both legs healed, but the right leg was misshapen, crooked, and shorter. In 1856, Fleming sued the doctors for $10,000 malpractice damages. Lincoln defended the doctors. Three law firms represented each side. At the time, public sentiment reflected an anti-professional and anti-social class biases. Aware of these prejudices, Lincoln secured four continuances and a change of venue to allow for a cooling-off period. The trial was postponed for 1 year. During that time, Dr. Carruthers coached Lincoln on bone physiology. They prepared old and young chicken bones for demonstrations to the jury. In 1857, the trial began. There were many medical witnesses. Almost every physician in Bloomington testified. Speaking to the jury about bone fractures, Lincoln forgot what he learned about bones. While demonstrating the flexibility of the bone of a young chicken, he said, quote, "This bone has all the starch all taken out of it as it is in childhood," unquote. Jurors easily understood the differences when Lincoln snapped the bone of an older chicken. An exchange during Lincoln's examination of Fleming impressed the jury. Lincoln, "Can you walk at all?" Fleming, "Yes, but my leg is short, so I have to limp." Lincoln, "Well, what I would advise you to do is get down on your knees and thank your Heavenly Father, and also these two doctors, that you have any legs to stand on at all." Lincoln emphasized to the jurors that the doctors used their considerable skills to try to save Fleming's legs. Lincoln contended the slight limp is nothing compared to the loss of the limb altogether. At the time, Lincoln knew that it was acceptable medical practice for doctors to amputate when treating a compound fracture. Infection was considered more of a threat to life than amputation. Jurors were unable to agree on a verdict, and a result was a hung jury.
You're listening to Alan Spiegel speaking on Abe Lincoln, Attorney at Law.
In December 1857, the defense petitioned the court for a change of venue for the retrial. Doctors Rogers and Carruthers claimed that, quote, "The inhabitants of this county are so prejudiced against them that they cannot expect a fair trial," unquote. The petition was granted, and the case was moved to Logan County. After 2.5 years, before a new trial, the case was settled out of court. Terms of the settlement are unknown because a courthouse fire in Lincoln, Illinois, destroyed the Logan County Circuit Court records. In 1847, Lincoln defended a slave owner. Robert Matson transported five of his slaves, Bryant and her four children, from Kentucky, a slave state, to Illinois to work on his farm. After living in slave-free Illinois for 2 years, the slaves sought refuge with abolitionists. Matson declared them runaway slaves. The sheriff imprisoned the slaves until the court decided when it was ready to sell them to the highest bidders. Acting on their behalf, Gideon M. Ashmore sued for their freedom. Matson retained Lincoln. In court, Lincoln responded to the application for freedom. He argued that a slave owner could take his property all over the country. In disagreement, the court ruled that the slaves were free. Matson was billed 37 cents per day for each slave, a total of $111.05 for prison care of the slaves. Rebuffed, Matson returned to Kentucky, but he failed to pay Lincoln his legal fee. Interestingly, the abolitionists also wanted Lincoln to represent their side. However, Matson got a commitment from Lincoln before they were able to do so. Lincoln often used humor in the court, even in a murder trial. In 1857, Lincoln prosecuted Isaac Wyatt for the murder of Anson Rusk. There were many eyewitnesses to the murder. Much testimony confirmed ongoing battles and disputes between the two men. During an argument, Rusk shot Wyatt and badly damaged his left arm. That arm had to be amputated. Lincoln felt it was an open and shut case. The defense lawyer claimed Wyatt became insane from an overdose of chloroform during the prior surgery necessitated by Rusk's bullet. Much expert medical testimony from both sides about the side effects of chloroform. Defense experts stated that picking of the head was a leading symptom of insanity. Lincoln cross-examined the defense's main physician expert. He used a sense of humor to discredit this expert. Quote, "You say, doctor, that this man picks his head, and by that you infer that he is insane. Now I sometimes pick my head, and those joking fellows at Springfield tell me that there may be a living, moving cause for it, and that the trouble isn't at all on the inside. It's only a case for fine-tooth combs," unquote. Even though the jurors laughed, they rendered a verdict of not guilty by reason of insanity. Wyatt was confined at the state lunatic asylum for many years until he seemingly recovered. He was released by the asylum's board of trustees with a unique release condition. He was told to return to his home in Indiana and never to return to Illinois again. In another humorous incident, Lincoln explained self-defense to a jury. He told them about an encounter between a man and a vicious dog. "Lincoln, that reminds me of a conversation between a farmer and man attacked by the farmer's dog. He killed the dog with a pitchfork. Farmer, why did you kill my dog? Man, what made him try to bite me? Farmer, but why didn't you go at him with the other end of the pitchfork? Man, well, why didn't he come at me with his other end?" Like any good lawyer, Lincoln had a rationale for selecting jurors. In 1858, Lincoln represented William Duff Armstrong, a young man accused of murder. Armstrong and James H. Norris engage in a raucous, drunken frolic and brawl on the outskirts of a religious camp meeting. An indictment charged them with the atrocious crime of savagely beating and killing James P. Metzger. A courtroom spectator described how Lincoln selected jurors for this trial. Since his client was a young man, Lincoln took pains to select young men as jurors. He believed that they could understand the youthful hot blood and be sympathetic. He succeeded, and the average age of the jurors was under 30. On picking the jurors, Lincoln avoided blue-eyed, blonde-haired men. He believed them to be inherently nervous and more likely to side with the prosecution in murder cases. Lincoln felt that dark-haired men with high foreheads made up their minds about the case beforehand. He did not select them unless he knew where they stood. Lincoln considered fat men the ideal jurors. They were jolly by nature and easily swayed. During this murder trial, Lincoln cross-examined the prosecution's key eyewitness. Charles Allen stated that he clearly saw Armstrong strike Metzger about the right eye with a slung shot on the evening in question. A slung shot is a striking weapon with a small mass of metal or stone fixed on a flexible handle or strap. Allen said he saw Armstrong hit Metzger by the light of a full moon shining real bright. He was 150 feet away at the time. This eyewitness was stunned when Lincoln showed him an almanac astronomy table for the day in question. This table indicated there was no full moon. The moon had already disappeared and therefore was too dark to see anything. Lincoln's client was acquitted. In the 1850s, Lincoln prepared notes for a law lecture. He made 3 points. First, he said, discourage litigation. Persuade your neighbors to compromise, save on fees and expenses. A lawyer has a superior opportunity to be a peacemaker and a good man. Quote, there will still be business enough, unquote. Second, never stir up litigation. Don't stir up strife to put money in your pocket. A moral tone ought to be infused into the profession. Lastly, Lincoln declared that there's a vague belief that lawyers are necessarily dishonest. That impression is common, he said. However, resolve to be honest. If you cannot be an honest lawyer, resolve to be honest without being a lawyer. Choose some other profession. Do not, in advance, consent to be a knave. After Lincoln's election as president, he spoke privately at his law office with William H. Herndon, his last law partner. Lincoln noticed the weather-beaten, wooden Lincoln and Herndon sign swinging in the stairwell. Perhaps with foresight, he told Herndon, quote, "Let it hang there undisturbed. Give our clients to understand that the election of a president makes no change in the firm of Lincoln and Herndon. If I live, I'm coming back sometime, and then we'll go on practicing law as if nothing happened," unquote.
But of course, Lincoln never went back to his law practice. He was shot on Good Friday, April 15, 1865, and died the next day. You've been listening to Alan Spiegel speaking on Abe Lincoln, Attorney at Law, and this is Talking History. We often link patriotism to unquestioning loyalty to our government and, during times of war, even to militarism. But as our guest commentator this week, Jonathan Hansen, shows, that has not always been the case, and in some important ways, it's not been the case in America since 9/11. As he points out, liberal dissenters can be patriots, too. Hansen is a visiting scholar at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and the author of The Lost Promise of Patriotism, published by the University of Chicago Press.
The events of 9/11 and ensuing war on terrorism have revived an interest in patriotism on the American left, not seen since before the Vietnam War. Once willing to surrender patriotism to supranationalists on the right, the left seems increasingly reluctant to do so. This reluctance ought to be encouraged. Not only would American democracy benefit from vigorous dissent undertaken in the name of patriotism, but liberal politics would acquire the rhetorical amplitude it so conspicuously lacks. There is nothing more patriotic, after all, than defending civil liberties and equality before the law at home, and human rights and the rule of law around the world. Americans inclined to contest the current reduction of patriotism to militarism and blind loyalty to the government will find themselves in good historical company. For such was precisely the course of a group of progressive-era intellectuals and social critics whose attempt to redeem patriotism from jingoism a century ago should interest all Americans. With the nation facing foreign and domestic challenges strikingly similar to our own, the philosopher William James, the Settlement House leader Jane Addams, the socialist agitator Eugene Debs, the civil rights advocate W.E.B. Du Bois, and the future Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, among others, propounded a vision of patriotism rooted in liberal democratic principles and committed to constant critical civic vigilance. The principal opposition of their liberal patriotism, as we might call it, was not between American and outside interests, as now seems to be the case, but between equality and justice on the one hand, and racism, sexism, industrial exploitation, and imperialism on the other. On the home front, The liberal patriots argued that the way to ensure genuine and lasting solidarity was not to intimidate immigrants and political dissenters, but to demonstrate the salience of the nation-state, i.e., the federal government, to the well-being of all Americans. E pluribus unum, meet quid pro quo. Internationally, the liberal patriots expected American foreign policy to uphold the democratic ideals regulating life inside the republic. For a nation founded upon the principles of self-government and the rule of law, they argued, promoting those principles internationally constituted the ultimate form of self-defense. Here, surely, was a vision of patriotism appropriate for a culturally dynamic society in a fluid, globalizing age. It is one contemporary Americans could be proud of.
You've been listening to Jonathan Hansen, the author of The Lost Promise of Patriotism. Hansen's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. As always, we welcome your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by regular mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, Joey Skidmore, producer, Fiona Beatty, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. A Moment in Time is produced by Dan Roberts and distributed by WCVE-FM in Richmond, Virginia. For more information, visit amomentintime.com. And Alan Siegel's remarks on Abraham Lincoln were provided by station WNYE in New York City and Erwin Gonchak, producer of Teacher as Historian, who invites you to visit their website at twc.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.